This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before the turn of the 20th century, some food in the United States actually contained known poisons. Food regulation practically didn't exist. Today, we'll share the story of an Indiana chemist who no doubt saved countless lives by exposing the poisons present in the manufactured foods of his time. Deborah Blum is the author of The Poison Squad, one chemist's single-minded crusade for food safety at the turn of the 20th century. And she joins us now from Boston. Deborah, welcome to All In.
Hi, Matt. It's great to be here.
And I should say that we're talking to you about this today because your book is being adapted for a documentary that premieres tonight, January 28th at 9 Eastern on PBS's American Experience. So I want to start with just a kind of overview of some of the problems of the time. It was really kind of the Wild West for manufactured food. What was someone likely to find in their food back in, say, the 1870s?
Yeah, that was a crazy time in the American food supply. And I should start by saying it's important to realize there's no food safety legislation in the United States in this part of the 19th century. So manufacturers can do whatever they want, and they do. And I'm going to talk a little bit about fraud. There was crazy fraud. You didn't have to have labels. You didn't have to tell people what was in whatever container they were purchasing. So you would see, for instance, brick dust in your cinnamon, or actually charred and ground bone in coffee. Coffee had this crazy array of adulterants and additives that also included burnt ropes. Pepper tended to be ground seashells or coconut shells. I mean, so you start seeing these kinds of fakes and frauds in the food supply. Ketchup at the time was often made of old pumpkin rinds that have been discarded, dyed red to look like tomato. They mix gypsum into flour. I could go on. And the other part of this is during the rise of the Industrial Revolution. You see all these new chemical compounds going into foods in different ways. You see the use of copper sulfate, which is a heavy metal, to make you canned vegetables greener. You see the use of poisons, literally poisons like arsenic and lead, to color food, right, because they're easily synthesized. And I usually like to dwell on milk and all of the problems with milk in the 19th century because it's such a great case study, but I'll stop here for now.
And so you're talking about all these crazy things going into, I mean, when ground up shells for pepper and things like that, they were just fillers, right? This was just for the company to save money.
That's exactly right. It was a license to be inventive in extending your profits. And one of the interesting things when you start drilling down to this is you can actually find the, circulars and letters and come hithers that manufacturers sent to food makers or to grocers to encourage them to use these things. One of my favorites, because I do like coffee, is that as people began sort of uneasily aware that ground coffee was, this mess of, whatever the manufacturer decided to throw in the can, people, you saw the American public starting to grind their own beans. And so manufacturers came up with fake coffee beans that you could mix into the real coffee beans. And there were special molds, and you could make these fake coffee beans out of clay or out of dirt and wax. And then you see sort of advertisements that go directly to the grocers. You can improve your profits if you'll just mix our special fake coffee beans into the real coffee beans. And people did it. I mean, it was all profit and it was no concern for the consumer.
And other than profits, why was this happening or why was this allowed? Were companies in the government's pocket or was this just not something that anyone thought of yet, the government regulating food safety?
I mean, there were some states that were real leaders in regulating food safety. Indiana was actually one. They passed one of the first food safety laws in the 1890s, way before the federal government did. You know, Massachusetts was another. You can see these sort of, the Dakotas were leaders in food safety, interestingly. But at the federal government, there were a couple of things going on. One was, there was a lot of money pouring into Congress from both chemical industries and food industries to persuade them not to mess with what was a very good thing for the manufacturers. And there was a lot of national resistance to the government policing what you ate, right? It was one thing for your state to get in there, but for the federal government to set standards for, you know, this disparate collection of states with their different interests, there was a huge amount of pushback on that. So you kind of had both of those things going on.
And it's not like nobody knew about this. There were people who knew. There were some who didn't, of course. But I guess, didn't I see that known, like some cookbook recipes added tips to counter some of these frauds that were happening?
Yeah, that's a great point, and it's a good illustration of just how crazy food was. If you look at cookbooks today or online recipes, right, depending on how you get your recipes, they never say, you know, a teaspoon of cinnamon, but you can't trust the cinnamon, right? So just be aware that it might or might not be. But back in the 19th and early 20th century, cookbook authors felt this need to say to the women, it was mostly women who were buying these cookbooks, beware. Right. And so you can find, I actually went to the Library of Congress and had them go through all the cookbooks of this time in history and find me examples of this. But you find them warning about cinnamon, in fact, and you find them warning about coffee. And one of my favorites is a very famous cookbook author, Fanny Farmer, who was one of the best-selling cookbook authors of the time. And she wrote a book about cooking for sick people, and she published it in 1904. She had to do a whole chapter about how dangerous milk was in that cookbook, right? Just be aware, if you want to make like a milk pudding or some kind of custard, right, here's what's dangerous about the milk. Here's what you can try to do to protect yourself. Just don't go out to the market and buy any old milk because you might just kill the patient.
Yeah, and on this, I guess on that subject, because this was where it got really serious, how many people were dying because of these food additives and preservatives?
You know, I've talked to food historians. Back in the 19th century, we didn't have a good epidemiology or public health service, really. So there's not hard numbers there. I mean, you can see if you troll around in 19th century newspapers, you'll find stories about, you know, a whole party that eats ice cream and everyone dies because of the contaminants in the ice cream, right?
Wow.
So food was dangerous. I have heard from people who do public health history that the estimate was that just the daily diet in the 19th century was one of the top 10 causes of death. And there's a wonderful medical historian, Howard Markel, at the University of Michigan, who calls the 19th century the century of the great American stomach ache. Because what? I love that phrase, right? I love to quote it because it really tells you that people didn't feel that great. They were eating all this bad food. They knew, as you say, some of it because you had cookbook authors and you know, food safety chemists, both at the federal and the state level, trying to get the information out there. But they were just starting to be aware of how bad things were in the 1890s, I think.
Before we get to the main subject of your book and of the PBS documentary tonight, Harvey Wiley, I want to talk about another Indiana figure while we're sort of on the subject of dairies. John Hurdy, and he was sort of active in the food safety movement at the time. What were dairies, I guess, responsible for at that time?
Well, there's no regulation of, you know, now we have all these regulations of milk, but there was no regulation at the time. So dairymen, which was the term used at the time, dairymen pretty much did what they wanted with milk. And so a couple of things were going on. And John Hurdy, who was Indiana's chief public health officer in the late 90s and into the 20th century, was a real national pioneer, really took on all kinds of important causes. I'm actually a big fan of his because I think he made a real difference. But he took milk as a particular example for a number of reasons. Dairymen watered the milk, right? Again, this is this, you know, how can I stretch my profit? They would water the milk. They would recolor it with chalk or plaster of Paris. They didn't really care what water they did. There's a great study that Hurdy did in the public health laboratories in Indianapolis. I want to say right about 1898, where they're looking at milk and the milk is wriggling because that dairyman had just pulled water out of the pond near his farm and it's full of horsehair worms,
oh
right?
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, it's just like that image is so incredible. Dairymen, when they would thin the milk and there would be no cream, would sometimes fake it by pureeing calf brains and floating the calf brains on top of the milk. And then, and this was where Hurdy, I think, really took a national lead. Dairymen would preserve milk with one of the new industrial chemicals, which was formaldehyde. And so formaldehyde became to public awareness in the Civil War. It was the number one embalming agent used in the Civil War. And you saw these different food industries saying, wow, that is very effective at preserving a rotting corpse. I wonder what it could do for food. And with milk, which was not pasteurized and was not refrigerated, because, of course, we don't have electricity and refrigeration back then, it tended to rot and it tended to grow a lot of bad bacteria. But you could dump formaldehyde in it, and it would stop the decomposition. And formaldehyde, I hear, I don't drink it, has a slightly sweet taste. And so
people didn't notice.
Also slight, yes, improved the taste of the milk. I mean, it's really amazing. You actually can see, again, these kind of flyers that are going to groceries. In other words, you know, sell this milk. Your consumer, your happy customer will be able to just put the milk out and it'll stay as it is for 2 weeks because of the magic of formaldehyde. And they didn't call it that, right? They called it preservaline or rosaline or, you know, icing or these other names. And then kids started to die. Right. You know, there's no standards. How much of this poisonous substance can I put in the milk? Who cares? You know, what's a safe level? Nobody knows. And so naturally the dairymen are like, well, if a little bit preserves the milk for 2 weeks, could I get a month out of it if I double it? And you start seeing, you know, outbreaks, what they call them embalmed milk scandals.
Yeah. We're speaking with Deborah Blum about her book, The Poison Squad. We'll be back in just a moment to talk about the subject of her book, The Poison Squad. Harvey Wiley, who was Purdue's first professor of chemistry, and he became a pure food crusader at the turn of the 20th century. And the book has been adapted into a PBS documentary, which premieres tonight at 9 Eastern. And we'll be back in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning science journalist Deborah Blum. She's the director of the Knight Science Journalism Program at MIT and author of The Poison Squad, which is about Indiana scientist Harvey Wiley's work exposing the poisons present in manufactured food at the turn of the 20th century. The book's been adapted into a PBS American Experience documentary, which premieres tonight at 9 Eastern. So, I mentioned Harvey Wiley. Here we go, Deborah. In 1874, he became the first professor of chemistry at Purdue University. He was a pretty extraordinary guy. What was his background at that time?
So he was raised on a small Indiana farm. He was actually helping to herd the cows. I don't know that they had that many by the time he was six. Mm-hmm. His dad was a real, you know, believer in serving mankind. He was a conductor on the Underground Railroad. He was a evangelical preacher. And he raised Harvey, I think, to really believe in this idea of science and the service of good. And Harvey got his MD. He studied. He got a medical doctorate in Indiana. And then he went over to Harvard and got a degree in chemistry. And he came back to Indiana, and he was hired as the first professor of chemistry at Purdue. They had a faculty of six, including the president, when he started. And so he built, really almost hand-built the chemistry laboratory. and he loved it. He loved teaching. He liked, he used to go play baseball with the students, right? Which kind of upset the Purdue, board of administrators, who thought he was a little too casual in the way he did things. But he got his start at Purdue, and he's got his interest in analytical chemistry there, right? Not just medical chemistry, but the idea of analysis. He really grew that when he was at Purdue.
And how did he start doing government work?
So he ended up, because he was actually a first-class analyst, he got tagged by the state of Indiana to analyze fake honey and fake syrup and other fake sugars in the state. Fake sugars and fake honeys were also a big problem back then. He did this very detailed, very impressive report, started looking at sugars in general, and was tagged by the federal government because they were also at the USDA very interested in the idea of sugar as a crop. He became the first, he became the chief chemist for the Bureau of Chemistry at the USDA. And the one thing he did there, that was in 1883, so he had been at Purdue for about 6 years when he went into federal service. And the one, or I guess a little longer than that, more like nine. But the one thing he really did when he went to the federal government is he took with him this interest in analysis and this interest in honest food. I think he learned all that in Indiana. I think he had a real respect for, you know, food in its purest state, which would be farm-grown food, right? Or wild food. And I think he learned to appreciate the power of chemistry to tell us what was real and was not real when he was at Purdue.
What were some of these fake products? You mentioned fake sugar, fake honey, and things. How do you fake something like that?
Well, honey was a pretty simple, and syrup were a pretty simple fake. So what they would do is they would just use corn syrup. Corn syrup, you know, rose into being a huge product actually in the 19th century, as production of corn starts spreading across the Midwest. And it's like, how can we use actually every single part of the corn plant? We've got these sugars. What could we do with them? And so there's this huge boom in corn syrup production back then. And one of the things they would do is they would just dye it brown or a little golden and then dump it into a bottle and call it maple syrup and sell it like the much more expensive product. Oh. And with honey, they not only did that, but then they would fake the honeycomb. There was a whole cottage industry and fake honeycombs that they would crumble into the honey. I mean, they were very creative with this, right? You kind of have to admire that.
And what was this experiment then that he did later in his career after he was through the food fakery and doing some work for the Indiana government and then the federal government? This experiment, which is the title of your book.
The Poison Squad. So Wiley gets very interested once he's at the federal government at looking at everything. He knows that sugars are faked. He looks at the, you know, dairy production, fake butters, the way red lead is used to make cheddar cheese more orange. He looks at that. They look at fakery and spices, fake liquor, fake wine. I mean, you name it, it was faked, right? And so he's looking at this sort of explosive growth in fake food. They do a whole series of reports. But he starts to realize that these chemicals they are using as part of the fakery are actually pretty dangerous, and no one has tested them. There's no study of anything that's going into the food supply. So in the 1890s, he's saying, could we just please label the food? If we're going to put formaldehyde in milk, let's say there's formaldehyde in milk so people can make a decision. And both the industry and, you know, the legislators that the industry owns are very resistant to that. So finally, in 1902, he says, okay, you're not going to let us do anything. Let's just show you let's actually look at what's in the food supply. Then let's skip all the wussy animal testing. You could never do that today, right? Let's go right to people. And so he devises this experiment. It was nicknamed by the Washington Post, the Poison Squad, in which he recruits government. It were young government workers who don't have very much money. And for $5 a month and three meals a day, free, on Uncle Sam, 7 days a week. They can get all of these wonderful benefits, wonderfully cooked food by a professional chef, extra money, and the only catch is they have to add to every meal the additive that Wiley is studying at the time. And then they have to do all these medical, intrusive medical tests, right? And they have to sign a waiver saying that if for some reason it kills them, they're not going to sue the government. And they get this huge outpouring of people who want to do it, right? Who like the idea of testing this out, who need the extra money. And so starting in 1902, he starts testing what he thinks of as the worst of the food additives on this group of young male volunteers, all kind of athletic young men in their 20s, because he thought they would be the sturdiest. And that was the beginning of what became known as the Poison Squad experiment.
And what were the worst of the food additives? What was he testing?
Well, one of them was formaldehyde. They had to call that test off because people got so sick so fast.
Wow.
But he's, yeah, I mean, if you can imagine having formaldehyde and a fairly large dose at every meal, you can see why that happened. But they started with borax. You'll see that today in the cleaning section of grocery stores, 20 Mule Team Borax, exactly the same thing. It was a popular preservative in meats and in butters and in milk. So there was a lot of borax in the diet. And they looked at copper sulfate. They looked at salicylic acid, which we know from aspirin, right? It's this, it's in that same family. We know, if you know that they buffer aspirin, that those acids cause the lining of your GI tract to bleed. Those were very popular preservatives of the time. But the interesting thing is when Wiley started, and he started with borax, he actually didn't think they were going to be as dangerous as they were. He didn't expect, like with the borax experiment, for these young men to get as sick as they did. And he would later, when he testified before Congress, say, "Yeah, I was converted by my own research." And it's at this moment where he's seeing these very healthy young men eating something that is in every kitchen pantry, across, I mean, literally every kitchen pantry in the United States every day. He starts changing, I think, from being that kind of cool-headed analytical chemist to someone who says, I've had enough. I've had enough. I have to make this change.
Now he's on a crusade.
Yes, that's exactly right.
And some of the Poison Squad, these healthy young men who volunteered to eat this, they got dangerously sick. And so when did the public start to take notice of this experiment, the Poison Squad experiment?
You know, this experiment really caught the public attention. There had been all of this sort of underlying awareness, especially, you know, among food chemists or among what they called pure food advocates, people who were really paying attention to this. But the general public did not become fully aware until these experiments caught the public attention. Right. And they were front page news across the country. And some of that was, you know, there was actually very sensationalist coverage from the Washington Post. And the reporter, his name was George Wathwell Brown, who covered this. If the stories weren't interestingly enough, he would sort of ramp them up. They started being minstrel shows about the Poison Squad. There were songs, there were poems. And when the first report came out, and that was the Borax report, coast to coast, front page coverage that basically said, what you're being sold every day at the grocery store is poisonous to you and is making you sick and is making your children sick in ways that you are not being told. And so you start seeing this sort of rising tide of public awareness and increasing public anger during the course of those experiments, which really ran from about 1902 to early 1905.
And this whole time, of course, big food is in the government's pocket and things. And so government, for that reason and many others, I mean, government is slow. They're slow to react to this. But there was a book that came out a few years later in early 1906 that really got people's attention. Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. What was it about?
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that. So you have this kind of slow-burning fire going on in the country. And then Upton Sinclair comes in, And he writes this very dramatic novel about life in the meatpacking yards of Chicago. And these are meat processors. They make canned meats and potted meats, and they also, you know, butcher cows and pigs and send them out to grocery stores around the country. And Upton Sinclair actually wrote this book. He wanted to call attention to the plight of the workers, right, who were treated horribly. But he went to Chicago. He actually spent 6 weeks disguised as a worker gathering notes about it. And so when he published the book, it had this incredible background of these horrible stories of meat processing, right? The rats are running wild in the factories and they poison them, and then the poison rats just go into the sausage and meat rots to the point that it grows a moldy layer, and they wash it off and give it, as he put it, a borax bath and put it into the canned hams and work. And of course, in his book, workers fall into the lye vats where they're processing meat and end up in the lard. Sorry. So he publishes this book. He wants the public to be all outraged on the, about the horrible working conditions. Instead, everyone who is already starting to say, man, the food supply doesn't seem very trustworthy, goes, that's it. Right. That's it. The food supply is out of control bad. And so he was, you know, we'll use the phrase the tipping point, but the jungle, you know, sort of was like gasoline poured on this fire. It just really exploded.
Yeah. Upton Sinclair wanted to draw the attention to the plight of the worker, as you said. And there's a great quote from him where he says, I aimed at the public's heart and by accident I hit it in the stomach.
Yes, I love that quote so much. And he was right. That's exactly where he hit the public, in the stomach. And what's also interesting, the book comes out, big scandal, right? Roosevelt doesn't trust Upton Sinclair, who is a socialist, right, which is why he wrote the book. He sends a fact-checking team to Chicago. They come back and go, oh, my gosh, it's worse. It's worse than in the book. And Roosevelt uses their report, which has never been fully published. It's still hidden in a vault of the library at the National Agricultural Library, right?
Really?
But he uses that report to blackmail Congress. And he says, if you don't pass a Meat Inspection Act, I'm going to publish this report, and I'm willing to destroy the American meat industry. And so he's able, as the very talented politician that he is, to force the issue.
So Wiley's work and the movement, along with the publication of Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, lead to the Pure Food and Drug Act, which eventually led to the FDA, though it wasn't called that for another 2.5 decades almost. Harvey was already the head of the Bureau of Chemistry, which grew as a result of this movement, but his tenure was controversial. What were some of the things that he was dealing with?
Well, he really was a consumer first kind of guy. And so when the Food and Drug Act was passed, he imagined that now we finally have these, you know, long awaited tools to ensure the safety of the food supply for the average consumer. And he was determined that that was all that he should care about. How do we make food safer? Let's get down into the nitty gritty of everything. Whereas the people he was working with at USDA, including the head of the Department of Agriculture and including Roosevelt, higher up, all felt that, you know, we didn't want to be too hard on business. We wanted to work with business. And so Wiley ends up in this kind of, which I don't think he had fully expected, on this battleground over these regulations and fighting for stronger regulations and seeing them weakened. And so the Pure Food and Drug Act, the Food and Drug Act, is a paradigm shift in the United States. You know, I really like to emphasize this. The Meat Inspection Act and the Food and Drug Act, which passed in the same month, June of 1906, are a paradigm shift in which the U.S. government says, yes, part of our job is to protect the American consumer in their everyday life. And when in the Constitution it says promote the general welfare, this is what it means. It means people's everyday lives, you know, the safety of American citizens as they just go about their job. And those two acts lay down the foundation for every other consumer protection act and safety that follows. But the law, and Wiley felt this strongly, is really weakened in this negotiation. It's a very secret behind-the-scenes negotiation with business. And so his Bureau of Chemistry is the forerunner of the FDA. He oversees this. He actually, one of the food inspectors he hired, Walter Campbell, became the first official commissioner of the FDA when that agency became fully formed in 1938. But in this battle between him and the government over how we actually set these standards, he eventually resigns, right? He becomes so contentious, things are so tough, he's made so many people angry that he just feels that he can't be effective anymore, and he resigns.
He resigned in 1912. And I guess in the last 30 seconds or so that we have, how was this legislation weakened? In what ways?
Well, the standards that Wiley wanted to set, very specific guidance, were actually taken out. So you had to play a guesswork game. And that doesn't work. And he knew it and everyone knew it, right? And that really wasn't fixed until the FDA came about.
We're speaking with author Deborah Blum about her book, The Poison Squad, about Indiana scientist Harvey Wiley, who tested preservatives commonly found in manufactured foods available at the turn of the 20th century. His work led to the creation of the FDA. His book is the book that Deborah Blum has written, has been adapted into a PBS documentary, and it premieres tonight at 9 Eastern. When we come back, we'll find out what's still legal to have in our food and what regulations have been rolled back in recent years. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our conversation with Pulitzer Prize winning author Deborah Blum, whose book The Poison Squad is being adapted into a PBS American Experience documentary, which premieres tonight at 9. So Harvey Wiley resigns from government work in 1912, frustrated that things aren't quite going the way he would like them to go. Big business is still in the government's pocket, though the government is doing something finally. So what does he then do afterward? He's still on his crusade.
Yeah, he was a crusader to the end of his life. So he actually took a job at Good Housekeeping, the magazine Good Housekeeping, back at the turn of the 20th. Women's magazines were real investigative, crusading kind of magazines. You know, it's interesting because the best series on corruption in the drug industry at that time was published in Ladies' Home Journal. So he goes to Good Housekeeping. He creates the Good Housekeeping Test Laboratories. He creates something called the Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval, right? He's really still testing food and calling out dangerous substances. He writes a column for women about food safety and health and nutrition, which is full of chemistry, I might add. And he crusades. He testifies to government. He contacts senators. He's trying to get them to, you know, continue to properly enforce the law. He writes self-publishes a very angry book, actually. He died in 1930, and the year before he died, he self-published a very angry book called The History of a Crime Against the Food Law, which goes through all of these, you know, sort of raids on the law and steps to weaken the law. And so he helps lay what is going to be kind of another advocacy push for better legislation, which will not happen until after his death.
Was his self-published book particularly successful?
No, I've got a treasured copy of that book. And it's a big mess of, it's great for an author like me because it's just full of documents and testimony and transcripts of hearings and all kinds of whistleblowing kinds of things, but it's not a great book. So it didn't really accomplish what he wanted to accomplish, I don't think. But it is a wonderful record. And it was followed in the 1930s by a book that I think of as much more effective, which actually, to me, relates to today. There were a couple of food consumer safety advocates they publish a book in the early 30s called 100 Million Guinea Pigs. There were 100 million citizens of the United States at that time, as opposed to, you know, closer to 350 million today. And their point was that we American citizens are the guinea pigs for industry, the chemical industry, the cosmetics industry, the food industry. And they had all these incredible examples of that. And in fact, and they pointed out some of the weaknesses we discussed earlier in the new law. And that second groundswell, followed by a scandal in which cough syrup killed over 100 children in 1937, again, a scandal kind of pushing us over the line, right, led to the 1938 Pure Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act, which created the modern FDA.
I want to go back to his work with Good Housekeeping. Does it seem like his work with Good Housekeeping was as impactful as his government work?
I don't think, you know, not in the same way, because he wasn't hands-on in the machinery of government, right? But in terms of raising public awareness and putting pressure on Congress, he remained pretty effective. And there was a really interesting fight in the late 1920s, I think I write about this briefly, in which the corn industry is has gotten the government to remove all corn products out of government regulations, seriously, right? Mm. So now we can do anything we want with corn syrup, and we can do and not label it and not safety test any products, right? Which, as we all know, because we know the story of high fructose corn syrup, would have been a mistake. And Wiley was instrumental in getting that shot down, right? So he remained a very important and influential crusader throughout his life.
So let's look at the impact Harvey Wiley and his contemporaries had on where we are today. Their advocacy, as we've said, created what became the FDA, which has made us safer, but it took a lot of people getting sick and some of them dying and a lot of public outcry to get there. And even then, it took a long time for the government to move, as it often does. What were some of the compromises in those first laws that were set back in 1906?
So one of the things was, and you see this somewhat today, the burden of proof for whether something was dangerous and had to be out of the food supply was put entirely on the government. And one of the things, so that there wasn't enough pressure on manufacturers to safety test their products. Unless the government could prove it was actually a dangerous product, it couldn't be taken out. And the only way, one of the things also in that early law that the government could do if they did think something was dangerous, they had to go formally to court and get a court ruling. And sometimes they won that and sometimes they didn't. Wiley, while he was still in the government, felt that there were byproducts of bleaching flour that were really dangerous. And they eventually lost that lawsuit at the U.S. Supreme Court level. And we still have bleached flour today. Wiley felt that there was too much caffeine in there was a whole raft of medicated, what they called medicated soft drinks in the early 20th century. Some of them early on contained narcotics, you know, cocaine in Coca-Cola. 7-Up was called 7-Up because it included things like lithium.
Oh.
Lithium was a primary. 7-Up picked you up, right?
Wow,
lithium, which is
so.
An antidepressant, right? And so he had really tackled that. And under the law, he was semi-effective in dealing with some of it. I mean, the government did eventually get Coca-Cola to ratchet down the amount of caffeine that was in their soft drinks in the 19-teens, right? In which they were actually selling soft drinks to like elementary school kids that were had in a single glass as much caffeine as we see in Red Bull today, right? And Wiley started that fight. It took them almost a decade to get that settled, and they really had to wrestle with that. So you see them trying to, you know, manage food safety and being very hamstrung by some of the rules in the law. They came up with a list of food coloring agents And Wiley and a food coloring specialist that he worked with got rid of almost 200 very poisonous food coloring agents, kept less than 20. And here's a crazy thing, except for a couple of those, which they had to take out in the 1950s, the food coloring agents that were approved by Wiley are still the ones we have today, right? His work still influences in all kinds of ways what we eat today.
Do we still see loopholes in food and drug regulation today?
I think we do. I mean, part of it is the other thing about that law, and this is more of a approach than, you know, something, anything else, is that we tend to use something that's called the generally recognized as safe principle. So we grandfather in a lot of food additives because people have not dropped dead in the street, right? It's generally recognized as safe. We don't even do the testing, right? Whereas in Europe or the EU, they use what's called the precautionary principle. So if there are materials that start turning up looking dangerous in tests, they'll take it out and they'll say, we're going to take this out until it's proved safe. So there actually are about 1,200 compounds in the American food supply that are banned in Europe because of the differences in approaches. I can come also address this if you want. We're seeing at this time some significant rollbacks in some of the safety rules we do have, and which is just a reminder that, you know, even though we have them in place, we're not guaranteed of keeping them.
I am curious about some of those rollbacks. What have we seen get rolled back?
Well, the two that I think are most interesting at the moment is that the current administration has rolled back a lot of rules on water protection, as you probably saw, a massive rollback in rules that, you know, that ensure clean water. But one of them has to do with the use of agricultural wastewater, which is often, especially in the dry western states, sort of recycled and used as an irrigation material. And the rules that limited the amount of fecal content in ag wastewater were lifted. And so you started seeing, as we certainly did last year, an increasing problem with lethal strains of E. coli on romaine lettuce. You probably remember there was a lot of scandals and recalls of romaine lettuce last year. That was a very dangerous strain of E. coli, and that was related to that rollback. So there you see a real cause and effect. The one that just happened actually pulls us back to pre-Upton Sinclair, and that is the Meat Inspection Act of 1906 requires that government inspectors actually inspect meat as it goes through the meat processing plants and, you know, give it a USDA seal of approval before it goes out to the market. It's not a perfect system, but we just rolled that back too, and in the pork industry, turned over the majority of pork processing back to the industry inspecting its own work and reduced the number of government inspectors in plants. And the beef industry has now come forward and saying, well, if you're going to do that for pork, you should do that for beef. So we are right in the process of seeing significant rollbacks, you know, in a law that was passed in 1906 because self-inspection was a big problem at that point. I think we don't want to go back to before the 1906 acts, right? We have all this evidence that these safety rules keep us safer. Food is not one of the top 10 causes of death in this country, and I am not suggesting that it's about to become that, but I am saying we don't want to move in a direction in which it becomes more dangerous, right? You know, we want to continue to say that allowing people to have some faith in their everyday food is important in any, you know, civilized country.
I remember
any country, civilized or not.
Of course. I remember the E. coli outbreak on romaine lettuce, but I don't remember ever hearing the end of it. This is the first I've heard that it can be directly linked to these ag runoff rollbacks.
there was a lot of evidence, and I saw some studies that showed that the implicating factor was agricultural wastewater. Mm. Now, there is always some fecal material in agricultural wastewater because it's running off farms, right? So whether this was just something that wasn't carefully policed, whether it's directly related to the roll-off back of those standards, I think you could argue that point to some extent, right? Whether it means that now that we've rolled back that those standards, we've increased this risk, I think you can argue that point too.
Now that you've dug through all of this and you've kind of looked at the modern day implications, I guess in your opinion, do you think that modern food labels tell us enough?
No, I don't. But I'm one of those annoying people who stand in the grocery store reading the labels, right?
Blocking the aisle.
Exactly right. I'm that middle-aged woman that everyone hates to see in the grocery store, nerdily reading the labels. I'll give you a couple of examples, and neither of these are necessarily things that you go, oh, I'm at terrible risk. A lot of times on a food label, you'll see cellulose, right? In pre-shredded cheese, often you'll see cellulose on the label. At least we put it there. And that's the material that is used to keep the shreds from sticking together, right? Cellulose is usually a form of wood pulp. I mean, what is it? It's really wood pulp, right? Mm. You'll see it sometimes in filler in those kind of cheap meats that have soy and cellulose and a little bit of meat in them, too. I feel like they should tell us that we're eating trees, right? I don't know that, you know, the fact that I'm eating a pine or an oak is going to kill me over, but what if I was allergic to oak? I would actually like to know that. I would like the labels to be honest, and that's, you know, not that hard to do. Wood pulp, right? At least tell me that. The other one that I tend to rant about is natural flavorings, right? I was just looking at a fruit-flavored seltzer in my office at MIT that said essence of lime. I'm like, what in the world is that, right?
I think I know the drink you're talking about.
You know, was it like some chemical that wafted past a lime? I mean, come on. And in fact, a lot of these so-called natural flavorings don't actually have to be natural under government rules, right? They can be synthetic versions, acetic acid rather than lemon juice, right? And I think we should be able to know that. I resent being told, as we all are, be an informed consumer and you'll be fine, when we're not getting the information to make the decisions we want to make.
We've talked about how some laws have been rolled back that are sort of, I don't know, I guess indirectly related to food, more related to agriculture. But we did do some modernization in 2011. We got about a minute left. Can we talk about the food safety modernization in 2011?
Yeah, the Food Safety Modernization Act passed under Barack Obama. It was actually in response to another scandal in which peanut butter killed a lot of people, and they came in and they said, let's apply modern methods, right, to ensuring food safety. We can, like, look down at the part per billion level. We can really figure out what's going on. We can up our game regarding what farmers do. That law is still in place. Parts of it have gone into place. Much of it has been put on hold, mostly through funding, right? So it's just not been fully funded. So that law, which I think would effectively was the law that was going to move us into 21st century food safety, is just not being implemented in the way that it should be, right? But there are parts of it, you know, using computer analysis to calculate risk and stuff, that I think we have put in place that are probably a very good thing.
She's the director of the Knight Science Journalism Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and author of The Poison Squad, One Chemist's Single-Minded Crusade for Food Safety at the Turn of the 20th Century. Deborah Blum, thanks for your work and thank you for your time today.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me on, Matt.
And remember, the documentary based on her book premieres tonight at 9 Eastern on PBS. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show today was engineered by Chris Flood. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, find it wherever you get podcasts. And be sure to subscribe so you always know what we're talking about. The impeachment trial is keeping most of our affiliates busy, but if we're on where you are, tomorrow we'll talk about the curious evolution of Indiana's libraries. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks so much for listening. This is All In.